and welcome to the Duck Industry Podcast, season number 4. The Duck Industry Podcast is a collaboration with the Programmers of Color Collective and What's Up with Dogs. It is funded by Creative Europe, the City of Leipzig, the BKM and MDM. We thank our partners and supporters for their contributions. Hey, and thank you for listening. Enjoy the show. This episode of the Duck Industry Podcast is brought to you in cooperation with Mubi. Mubi is a global streaming service, production company and film distributor dedicated to elevating great cinema. Mubi is a place to discover ambitious films by visionary filmmakers, all carefully chosen by Mubi's curators. Mubi now also cooperates with cinemas on the Mubi Go project. With Mubi Go, members receive a free ticket every week to experience a new handpicked film at the cinema. This way, you can be among the first to watch films like Asteroid City, Barbie and Past Lives at the cinema for free. The Mubi Go offer is currently available to the members in Germany, the UK, the US and India. As a Duck Industry listener, you can try Mubi, including Mubi Go, in the aforementioned territories for 7 days free of charge at mubi.com and mubi.com/go. This offer is available until the 31st of December 2023. Hey, once again, thanks for listening. Let's go!
Welcome, everyone. I'm thrilled to welcome you to this episode for Doc Leipzig entitled Animating the Documentary. My name is Maria Cristina Villaseñor. I'm a writer, media curator, and programming director of the New York International Children's Film Festival. I'm very honored today to have speaking with us two amazing co-directing teams, Camrish Johnson and Pedro Piccini, who are the co-directors of the beautiful award-winning short film Grab My Hand, A Letter to My Dad, and also Jorge Villalobos and Carlos Hagerman, the co-directors of the award-winning feature film Home is Somewhere Else. Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
It's so great to have all of these voices joining us from across the U.S. and across North America, and also to be recording this via Germany. So welcome from Mexico, welcome from LA, welcome from New York. And it's also a thrilling opportunity to speak in various languages, as you'll soon be hearing from Home is Somewhere Else, and to be, you know, talking about these not only cross-cultural stories and important stories in terms of representation, but also artistically really fascinating explorations of animation and documentary, looking at those terms, looking at what they mean, and having, I think, some really fruitful conversations. So what I want to do to ground you all as the listeners in this conversation is to just play a couple of short clips from both works. Obviously, you won't be seeing the visual component, but I'm sure that you're going to be wanting to check out links and find out more. But already, you'll sort of get such a wonderful sense of these pieces from these short clips. So I'm going to start with Grab My Hand, A Letter to My Dad.
The most valuable lesson my dad has ever taught me was actually the most recent one. My dad met my Uncle Dwayne in middle school. No blood relation, but he's part of my family. And every single morning since they were kids, my uncle will call my dad and say,
"Gate check."
It's my uncle's way of making sure my dad is what he calls out the gate, meaning alive, awake, and on his way to work.
Gate check, old man.
They heard a joke in a movie once that sparked the idea, and eventually,
gate check, fool,
became their daily routine, their best bud wake-up call. So over the years, through weddings, graduations, birthdays, divorces, and all of the many things life would throw at us, my dad's one constant was those two words.
Gate check.
Hi, gate check.
You know that old saying, you are who you surround yourself with? That must make my dad a pretty hilarious, compassionate, giving superhero who makes mistakes just like anybody else. Because that's my Uncle Dwayne. They're two superheroes that don't have it all figured out, but they'll never let you know that. Because whatever you need, even if they don't know how to get it, they'll find a way to help. That's what superheroes do.
All right. Grab My Hand, A Letter to My Dad. And next, I'm going to play a clip from the trailer for Home is Somewhere Else.
Lo que les voy a mostrar, perhaps you've never seen.
Three stories out of millions of others. Freedom.
Five or six. My mom woke me up in the morning.
Le dije, vamos, porque tu papá parece que lo agarró la policía.
I can't go back to Mexico and see Grandma because that means I will have to cross the border again.
I couldn't. Like, I was shaking. I was crying. I was throwing up. I was so scared.
I was raised deep in the Utah mountains, where the Provo River flows. That's why I'm here, to tell you about mi gente, the undocumented.
Right, home is somewhere else. So these films are so resonant on so many levels. They're such innovative approaches to documentary filmmaking, nonfiction filmmaking. And visually, they take an entirely new tack to what the potential of nonfiction filmmaking can be. So let's start off by just focusing on the stories themselves and how they came to life in terms of this realization through film, but also through this creative collaboration in the film team. So let's start off with you, Cameras, and this very personal and imaginative story that you chose to tell through Grab My Hand.
Yeah. First, it's very good to see you, MC. My friend, big fan of you, as you know. And it's also very good to see my co-director and buddy, Pedro. This film came out now 4 years ago, so it's just really great to see that we're still being able to talk about this thing together. So Grab My Hand, A Letter to My Dad came about in a funny way. I was working as a waiter at a restaurant for exactly 4 weeks. I was not cut out for this job. And Pedro was... He'd come in every other day, and he was just a very cool guy. So on my very last day, I said, "Hey man, you're cool. We should be friends. And what do you do?" He said, "I'm an animator." And I said, "Oh, cool. I've always wanted to make an animated short," which was not true. But I really wanted to work with him. So I pitched him some ideas, and we came up with this really cool short called Blue. And we started working on it together, and it was going to be like my first, you know, sort of stint in animation. So Pedro was sort of holding my hand through the process. And then suddenly my dad's best friend and my uncle Dwayne passed away. So I was talking to Pedro throughout the entire time he was in the hospital, like, man, I really want to make something for my dad. He doesn't really show his emotion very well. So I wanted to create something that could force a Southern military black man to emote. And I wrote this script. It was about 10 pages long, dialogue and characters and scenes and all kinds of stuff. And I sent it to Pedro. I was like, "What do you think? Do you think I could get someone to make this with me?" And Pedro was like, "This is great. There's no way you're going to get this done fast and cheap." So Pedro was like, "What if we did this other style of animation that was all narrated?" So he said, "Just write what you're trying to say. And if you want to do it like this," Pedro said, I've always wanted to make a short film like this. So if you're down to create this sort of like run and gun, raw, you know, narrated piece, write what you're trying to say, send me the audio, send me some suggestions and some shot lists of what you're thinking of. And then I'll just sort of take over from there. And Pedro, I don't know if you want to speak to that, but I sort of called it like free animating.
Yeah, basically it was a funny process, you know, from different perspectives. Like one Cameras, you know, this guy that we've been connecting pretty well, like I said, when the previous shot we're working on Blue. But then, you know, it was a new relationship, and then all of a sudden I get this like extremely personal you know, content coming from him. It's like, hey, guy, do you want to, you know, go deep into my family, like personal history, and just like work on this with me? So that was, you know, that was big for me. And I thought it was awesome. And then there was the question of time too. Like Hammer said, we wouldn't be able to do anything, you know, that involved character lines and like character like lip syncing or anything like that. And that goes back to our exchange in like, say, like just write what you're trying to say. And I think that's how we approach the animation as well. So that I believe, like, what I like to think our animation is more, we're illustrating concepts and not, you know, we're not describing things. We're just adding a different layer of feeling, sort of, you know, so to speak, to the story. And it was super fast. You know, we wanted to get his dad at that most vulnerable moment, you know, and I wanted to be special for his family. It was like a gift to a friend, basically, but we wanted to do it right. I didn't want to be like insensitive or, you know, offensive in any way. I was just trying to make it right, but with the time that we had, so.
He means we finished this in like 2 months. It was like 2 to 3 months. Yeah. It was very, very fast.
Yeah. I was working at the time. So it was like, you know, doing my free hours, just exchanging emails with cameras. Like, what do you think of this? Okay. Now I'm going to execute. You know, it was like really, really fast, but also very rewarding too.
Yeah.
There are two things that you said, Pedro, that I want to call out. One is, talking about animation as another layer of feeling over this very personal story, true to life story that Camrys wanted to tell. And the other of it as of your work as an animator back to Camrys, the filmmaker, as a gift to him. So I think those are really beautiful ways to talk about this sort of exchange of creative minds. And I also love that we're starting out with you talking about making this very deep, obviously important, personal, but also very significant in terms of what you were saying, Camrys, of, you know, masculinity and sort of getting at sharing emotion, the positive representation of Black male stories. You know, this is really deep film. And you're talking about it in this very offhand, like, let's just do this. Let's get this done. Let's bang it out. So I love that approach. And I think it's also like probably going to be a little bit of a counterpoint to now Carlos and Jorge talking about their project. And they have which I think is absolutely beautiful. And is, you know, the best way to kind of share these stories with everyone is that you can approach them in so many different ways. So I want to now flip this over to you, Carlos, and have you introduce yourself and Jorge. And I know that you have, you know, a depth of experience in documentary that was not necessarily animated. So if you could maybe introduce a bit more about Home is Somewhere Else and you and Jorge and your relationship creating this work in that way.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we're really thrilled to be here. And I was very surprised when I saw Camrys' film because of the kind of the emotional, really getting into that feeling. And I completely agree with that approach to documentary filmmaking. I think that both of our films, in very different, because this is not our stories, these are stories of three immigrant families that live in the US, Mexican families with mixed status. And it's basically a film about family and about what it means to leave, being afraid of family separation. What we have found through the experience of showing this film in many places is that the emotionally, the animation plus the very sincere or very real tale, especially told by the protagonist of their own stories, is very powerful. I am Carlos Hagerman. I'm co-director and producer of Home is Somewhere Else. And I have been doing documentaries for almost 15 years, and this is my first documentary short feature. No, this is my first animated feature, and the first time that our studio, we are partners, Jorge Villalobos and I, we co-directed this film together, and Jorge has a lot of experience, many years of experience in animation. And we got together and we tried to make an animation studio that would have as a mission to use animation as a tool to tell important stories. We are kind of more into like helping organizations. We started helping organizations on telling things that they wouldn't tell in animation because maybe the budgets didn't have enough budgets, but organizations that dealt with human rights and also especially in Mexico, we were working with the Commission of Defense of Human Rights a lot. And we sort of got kind of this way of how do you tell these really dark stories and put them out there so that people can see them, and how that is important as well. And then Homie Somewhere Else started with the experience of Jorge, so I'll let him tell a little bit about the story of that.
Hello again, Jorge Villalobos here in Valle de Bravo in Mexico, where we have our studio, Brinca. And we've been working in Brinca since 11 years ago. I think we, from the start, Carlos and I knew that we wanted to use animation to talk about some things that maybe in other way can be more difficult. Or no, I'm going to put it in another way. I think animation is the best way to talk about some things. It makes easier to approach audiences, because some of these matters are like very hard or very sensitive. So even though we didn't knew when we founded our studio that we were going to make an animated documentary, I think that in some way we were working on this, like in a maybe subconscious level. And then I think another thing that helped build this story is like the very long story of our friendship. We've been friends for more than 30 years, which is a long, long time. And so I think we know each other so good, and we know what we like and what we don't like. And Carlos, it's more oriented to documentary, and I am more oriented to animation. So it's maybe like two slow trains that were going forward, and then they collided in slow motion. And then this movie came from this slow cook explosion, to put it in a strange way. But I think if we didn't knew each other so good, it would be very difficult to make something as complicated as an animated documentary. In talking about more specific things, how this story came out, even though we were always looking for stories that we thought that matter to the community or to the society. 5 years ago, I was living in Miami, and there, Donald Trump, that year, the year I arrived to Miami, Donald Trump won. And then the narrative of migration and deportation became very aggressive and very big and very notorious. So everyone was talking about this. So obviously, I had the proximity and the opportunity to living there to be in touch and to meet these families who were living this kind of circumstances. And I think that when I talked the first time with Jasmine, that is the protagonist of the first story of the film, she was 11 years old. And when she told us her story about being a US citizen, but being afraid of losing her parents at any moment, when we listened, like this very powerful mixture of a very clever girl, a very brave girl, but also she was 11. She was very naive. I don't know what's the word, like ingenuidad, like she was a small kid. I think this mixture made something very powerful. And then we saw her drawings that she made the first day we met, because that was like the way to begin to know each other. I told her, why don't we draw something before starting to ask you things that are very complicated, let's play a little. And so when we saw her drawings and we had like this voice, like something like make a click, and we said, this can work, to have the voices of these families, but trying that all the visual is like if we were getting inside their heads, like trying to use animation to increase the subjectivity of what they're telling, even though you always are told that documentary is the objective, the objectivity of the, but I think that's not, I think you can play with that. I think you can respect the truth, but you can make more layers. You can like make more to enrich the narrative. I don't know if that's correct, like to make it richer. And I think that the animation is a very, very powerful way to it's like if you are hearing someone and the animation is like the subtext of what they are saying. So I think we discovered that, and we knew in that moment we wanted to make this bigger, not just because first we made just a 2-minute clip of Jasmine, but then when we saw the results, we knew we could make this into a feature film, and that's where this adventure began.
Fantastic. I love the way that you are describing creating animated documentary as a point of entry for an audience and thinking about that receptivity. And I'd love to just kind of open this up to our listening audience just think a little imaginatively about these terms. And so I'd love to just kind of go around to you all and ask you to respond with a few associative words when we talk about documentary. So let's just start with that term, documentary.
Reality.
When you are, you become a vehicle for other people's stories.
Pedro.
I mean, yeah, I think, yeah. Both these, in my point of view, sorry, it's documentary. Just go back to documenting. You know, documenting might be facts, might be reality, but also a point of view. After all, you know, movie. If we're showing something through a camera, there's editing, anyways. You know, there's no, it's not all the truth that is in the world, but it's also our take on the reality that we
want to
share.
Yeah, I guess documentary makes me think the words raw, gritty, personal, and heartfelt. I feel like you can't really get closer to an individual and their story outside of a documentary. So.
Yeah, I would add like paying attention, like see and listen. Contrary to animation, where everything is about creating and proposing and talking and drawing, I think documentary is about being receptive about something that's happening outside of you, maybe.
Yeah, documentary is very much about listening, I think. Being able to take a moment to hear about someone else's quite personal story oftentimes. To your point, I think when it comes to animation, it's a beautiful way to tell a story, but I think documentary is a beautiful way I guess this might be a little confusing, but I guess as an audience member, watching animation can be a lot more fun and takes less responsibility because there's so much more to look at. There's so many more things to distract you from the theme or the pain in it. Where in documentary, you're sort of forced to sit there and sit in their pain with them for a bit. So that's a bit more empathetic of a art style.
Empathetic, interesting. And Camrus, you have a storied career as an actor, as a filmmaker, as a scriptwriter, and also as an animated filmmaker, because you've continued to work in this medium. So let's move it over to there. What does animation mean to all of you?
Good question. I think animation, there's truly nothing like it. I forget what my quote was when I spoke at the New York International Children's Film Festival, but it was something like animation gives you the ability to put your heart on screen exactly how you imagine it. And there's something about the art form that is just so specific and I don't know, I want to almost use the word perfect because you can truly redraw it and recolor it and re-edit it over and over again as long as you want until you like are like, that's it. That's exactly how I see it. Where there's not many art forms you can do that and show it, like showcase it to such a large audience. So although I come from the live action world and I continue to work in the live action world, I do have such a huge love for animation. So I guess words that come to mind would be some of the many I just said, which would be, I guess, specific and I guess perfect. I mean, I hate using that word, but it truly is true because the thing about animation is that it's so much easier to hide the medicine in the orange juice. It's so much easier to like, you know, tell the viewers one thing, but they don't realize that they're listening to it. And I always go back to when I was watching the first episode of Static Shock, which is one of my favorite animated shows growing up. And, you know, as a kid, I'm watching this show because it's about a black nerdy teenager that gets electricity powers. And like, that's why I'm watching the shows, because he's a superhero. But, and upon reflection as an adult, the first episode, he got his superpowers because the police shot a smoke bomb and hit all this gas to break up a gang fight, which is just like, like I'm learning so much about his environment and like, you know, where he's living and the circumstances of not coming from a lot of money and all those things, but I'm distracted by the fun and the color and the superpowers. And there's another episode about, you know, a school shooting. But again, like as a kid, I wasn't realizing the things that I was learning because I was distracted by the perfection of the animators and the directors and the writers creating this beautiful world that distracted me from the things that they were actually teaching me. I just didn't realize. Anyway.
I think the first word that comes to my mind is playfulness. I think that's one of the things I've always loved about animation. Watching it, obviously, when you're a kid, you're like playing in your head. Like it's like so much fun. Generally, of course, there's other animation that can go very dark, but when you're a kid and you're seeing, it's like something that it's always surprising you. And I think that like tells you if watching it is that fun, maybe you can do it. Then you discover it's not that fun as watching it.
It's not that easy.
But there's always this element of playing. And that's something Carlos and I talk a lot about making this is let's have fun. Neither of us are animators. I direct animation, but I'm not an animator per se. But we like a lot of to play with images and references. And I think that this freedom where you cannot make a mistake when you're animating, when you're interviewing someone in a documentary, you can make it very wrong and blow up the whole conversation. But when you are animating, you cannot go wrong, because you can erase or you can use the mistake. Or so I think that freedom of let's do and let's go wherever we want to and let's have fun. I think for me, it's one of the things I love most about animation.
Yeah, for me, if one word comes to mind when I think of animation, it's possibility, in the sense of, you know, through animation, the same way as painting and other graphic arts, you can represent something that doesn't necessarily, is not subject to reality, right? It's not subject to the physics of our real world. It doesn't depend on something that already exists to be captured. So it's I think the shortest path from something that's inside your head to someone else's, you know, and then that's still open to interpretation, so they can see whatever blob or whatever thing that you make and come out with their interpretation out of that. Of course, you do have, you know, abstract and experimental films that, you know, like live action films, but I feel like animation can, contrary to maybe, I think, sorry, live action films, I think, is already subjected to a few rules, right? If you see someone making something abstract, there's like a material that will dictate a sort of interpretation that you will have out of that, right? Like, you look at something and you understand, like, you're living the world helps you understand what that is, you know, and make your own assumptions. Well, animation, the only limitation is your technique, I think, or the techniques of whoever you're collaborating with. So, sorry if I made it extra confusing, but
That's okay.
Yeah, that's clear.
That's the cool thing about animation. It can be confusing, yeah. It can still be cool, you know.
That to me is the best way to, you know, talk about art. It should be confusing. It should be, you know, crystal clear and confusing at the same time, because it's generative, right? And you want to inspire that in your audience.
Yeah.
For me, animation is the fantastic possibility of creating a metaphor of reality. So the metaphor, it's, you have to choose a graphic style for your animation. You're creating a world that's already a metaphor, but you can also use narratively metaphors, which creates eerie images, or, you know, nightmarish images that can relate to what the character is actually feeling. And I think that that's beautiful, because when, like, fiction is stuck with imitating reality, and it takes a lot of energy for that imitation of reality to take place. And the documentary world, you are there with the protagonist of their own stories, even if you yourself can be that protagonist of that story, but you are there with them. So there is, all the energy can go into the narrative, and you don't have to convince people, okay, well, this is this character and this is his house or her house. You're already seeing it. But by seeing, by creating such a real context, also what happens to documentaries, that people enter documentary and say, well, this is not my life, you know? Mm-hmm. This is his or her life, and this is his or her reality. And you can get detached of that reality. And then in animation, there is like all filters, you know, all your shields, you kind of take them out, because, you know, animation comes from that early experience, as Cameron said, of what was it as a kid watching animation. And in an animated movie, you can have the character start singing, and you can then learn the song by heart. And then, you know, wonderful things can happen. Imagination can happen. And it's all about how do we enrich the narrative of what we're trying to say, and how we go into what's really happening inside the character. That's what I feel that animation. So when you have documentary and animation, it seems like it's like oil and water. They're not going to mix, you know. But I always say that, yeah, you know, but it's more like oil and vinegar, you know, and then you mix them and it's more tasty than just vinegar or just oil.
I hope it tastes better than just oil.
I knew you were going to go with that, that very great alchemical sort of metaphor. So thank you for bringing it back to the idea of metaphors and kind of charging something. I love that. And maybe this is a good moment to talk in with more specificity about Home is Somewhere Else, because it's a really intriguing approach to telling these three very important and moving stories about undocumented families in the U.S. And it's done importantly in three different animation styles. So if you could talk a bit about the genesis of that and also bring it back a little bit to the way that Jorge, you were speaking about drawing or animation sort of being this initial point of entry with your first subject, Jasmine. So tell us a little bit about honoring the subjects in your film and communicating through this visual approach and how you went about deciding on the three different animation styles for these three different stories in the film Home is Somewhere Else.
Yes, as I was telling briefly before, the visual style for Jasmine's story was very natural, very, it felt very organic. It was even very easy, because when you see her drawings and you hear her voice and everything match perfectly, and you are seeing the you're like seeing the world through how Jasmine saw the world. She painted the hands in a very peculiar way, and always the hands, the legs and the arms were like spaghettis. And everything was like very simple. But also that became a big challenge for animators, because there was very little elements. I mean, the heads, there was no noses. So when you have a profile, there's no nose. So it was very challenging also to make it animated. But in terms of the visual style, it felt very natural. And what we like about that was that it made the personality of Jasmine like bigger. I think that you understood her better when you saw these drawings. And then that set like the bar for the styles of the other two stories, which didn't came out so easily. It was more trying to think, how can I represent visually two sisters that are far away, that haven't seen each other in a long time? And I think we were very lucky in that sense, because Carlos accidentally got into a museum and saw this painting of Aura Moreno Lagunes, which is a woman painter from Querétaro, who has been painting portraits of women all of her life. And she has this watercolor technique, and she puts objects to the portraits, like pieces of cloth and pins and metal. And so it was like something like a little bit like Chagall, like something a little bit dreamy and very poetic and very lyric. So also I think that we were all the time very paying attention. And I think that when Carlos saw that and something connected, like we always try to listen when there's something that you like in that moment, we generally try to go in that way, because there's something that clicked. So we went with that style, which I think it worked beautifully. And then the style for the third story of Lalo, which is a story more like an anti-hero. It's a more very dramatic story. And we knew in the same way that stories are like ascending in a dramatic way, each time they are getting a little bit more, the narrative is more, not only the narrative, but the story, it's more complicated and there's more drama in the stories. We also wanted that the visual style had like this development, that it grows. So if you're beginning with a drawing with crayolas and color pencils, and then you have like watercolor, we knew the third one had to be like a little bit higher. That's the style that has Carlos besides him in the poster, that is more like a graphic novel style with very bold and very more aggressive strokes of the pen, with more contrast in the color. And so that was a work done by Alonso Ross, which is a artist that works with us, and he makes a lot of graphic novel. So we wanted like that kind of aesthetic, like graphic novel, and also a little bit more cinematographic in the sense of the camera angles and the movements and the depth of focus. And so it was, again, very fun to find all these visual styles.
And did you think at some point about how these different visual styles and they're also, so the three different stories focus on young people of different ages and ranges. Did you think about how those different visual styles would communicate to an audience? I'm curious about just opening this up as well to this conversation of how you create a point of entry for these true to life tales through the audience. How did that affect how you thought about showcasing this film?
Well, we always wanted for this film to go to a broader audience than the audience that usually watches documentary. And we wanted also to be available for younger audiences. That was one of the reasons we chose animation to tell these stories. We thought that if we're going to tell stories from the young members of these families, from their perspectives, we should be able to tell it also to young people and have them put themselves in the shoes of this protagonist, and that in a younger age, especially in your teenage years, when you are developing your social identity, I think it's very powerful, because then you will see these families in a different way from that moment on. So we also were preparing this film from its origins and from the conception of the film to be also a tool for schools to talk about these issues, and so that you could have a discussion of these themes through the experience that these animations give to you. And I think that is something that animation kind of opens up, you know, like I think it's very valuable that you get a wider audience for these stories.
Absolutely. And Camrus, I'd love to bring it back to you in thinking about sharing this tale of a father and son, and what you thought about in terms of it communicating to an audience, and maybe a little bit about your experiences afterward, which have just kind of gone on, and here we are. So yeah, share.
Yeah, it's funny because I, you know, me and Pedro never planned to put this in festivals or have it in theaters. I mean, the whole plan was to show it to my dad, and then after he watched it, it was kind of like, all right, we did it. So we showed it to my dad, and him and I cried, and we hugged and had our moment. And then I sent it to my aunt, whose ex-husband ended up passing away, and my cousins, who he was the father of, and they were really inspired by it. And it actually inspired them to open up a nonprofit, which was really nice, in honor of him. But then, you know, after me and Pedro made it, I was already like, all right, Pedro, let's go make that first short we're going to make. And Pedro was like, I have to go work now and make money. So we never got a chance to do it. So I just showed a couple of friends, and I was like, hey guys, like, I made this thing for my dad over the past few months, if you want to check it out. And to my surprise, all of them cried, and they were all very different ages and races. And, you know, it was interesting to me to see that my friends who had never met my dad connected with this story that felt so personal to him. So I truly just started submitting it to festivals to try to get Pedro some love, because he, you know, did so much incredible work on it. And then when I started submitting it, it asked who the director of it was. And I was like, director? I don't know. So I asked Pedro, like, hey, man, who directed this? I mean, this isn't really a short film, but like, if I start submitting it, I have to call it that. So who is the director? And he was like, I mean, both of us, I guess. I was like, yeah, okay, cool. And I started submitting it. And then to both of our surprises, it just sort of went everywhere. It sort of accidentally became our directorial debut and started, you know, winning all these awards, which is really, really incredible. Up until this year, where we won the Amplify Award at the at Sundance through their partner, the Wind Rider Summit. So for 4 years straight, I think at this point it's gone to over 100 festivals. It's won over 20 awards. Yeah, so it's been lovely. And Pedro, I don't know how your experience has been. I know for me, I've been sort of like in it for the past 4 years, but every now and then I've just been like, hey man, we won another award. Hope you've been well. So like, I wonder how that's been for you since you worked on it so long ago.
Yeah, and I'm just going to give a little shout out to the New York International Children's Film Festival where it won the Oscar qualifying jury award. So
it sure did.
Mm-hmm. All right. So Pedro, yeah, what's that been like for you? I'm so enamored of this idea of it as a gift. But clearly it touched such a nerve, I think, of people wanting to have a place to express emotion and especially in that father-son relationship. Tell us how this unexpected but much merited success was for you in connecting with audiences and your intent.
It was crazy. Like Cameron said, you know, it was what started with, you know, just basically like two boys laying on their stomach, you know, like doodling in a sketchbook and like, oh, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? You know? And in the end, we were like on a stage for talking to people about what we did, something that, you know, you completely didn't expect. And, you know, and then there's that professional kind of the part of my ego that speaks loud, like, well, but like, I made it in such a hurry, you know, like, is it true that people are like, really like this? You know, like, I really believed in the story and I thought it was beautiful because, like, you know, on camera's part, it was just like, man, this is deep and I hope I didn't botch it for everybody. So when I saw the reactions and like how people connected to it, the same way I did, right? Because I believed in it from the beginning. It was incredible. It was like very reassuring and also frightening having to talk to people about, you know, something that you made, especially this personal is always very hard, but it was amazing. It's crazy that, like Cameron said, every time he texts me, oh, there's this other award. So like, you know, thinking that film got legs was already crazy. That it would run this far was even crazier.
Yeah, it truly has been unbelievable. And I just should shed a little more light on how sort of like run and gun and raw it was. We didn't even have music on the short in the beginning because, again, it wasn't a short. It was just like a project for my dad. Then randomly, a guy that I went to high school with, we weren't even friends in high school. We just like knew of each other. He reached out and said, hey, I saw you that you've been writing recently. His name is Fraser Smith. And Fraser said, I see you've been writing. And if you ever need music for anything, I just graduated, you know, school for music. And I was like, oh, cool. I made the thing for my dad. I'm not going to like pay you. But if you want to throw some music magic on here, like I may use it, but I probably won't. And then he put the music on there. And I was like, Pedro, listen to this. And after listening to it, Pedro was like, there's no way we can't have the music on there when we show it to your dad, because it really just tied everything together. So it's funny how like this thing that we really just pulled together, and it was just like something that we thought was powerful but simple. Like, we just like, how do we get this done quickly and efficiently? And what happened was we made such a specific story for one specific person that ended up being a universal story. And then for us, for the past 4 years, it's just been wild to go to a festival and speak in front of an audience and see people cry. And suddenly I get screenshots of text messages of people saying gate check to their father or a gate check to their best friend, like having their daily and weekly check-ins because this 5-minute short that we made for my dad inspired people around the world. It's still to this day, just crazy to me.
Yeah. Let's also talk about representation on screen, something that is super important to me and to us, I'm sure all here. I want to bring this around to everyone, but let's start with you, Cameras, to also talk about how perhaps this inspired you to continue telling personal / universal stories. And maybe you can share a little bit about She Dreams at Sunrise with us.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this short taught me a lot. And one thing that it taught me was how important it is to see Black faces in the animation space, both behind and on camera, or on screen rather. I think that it was really important to me when we were making this to have the two Black superheroes shot in it, because it's just something that is so simple, but so meaningful to me. And also having personal stories to people of color in animation. I think we're so used to seeing, nowadays things are thankfully changing, but for most of our lives, a lot of white faces in animated films and shorts. And this film truly inspired me to make my next animated short film, which was She Dreams of Sunrise, as you said, which is a short that is about when I was a caretaker of my great aunt. And it was both a representation of just Black people and a Black story, but also showing a young Black 18-year-old kid taking care of an older Black, you know, 72 to 73-year-old woman at the time. Because that's one thing that I really wanted to see is Black people just taking care of other Black people. And, you know, especially in that sort of switch of age. So yeah, I think showing that diversity of it not only makes people watching it feel more connected to people of color, because animation has this thing where it feels like no matter who you are, what you are, when you watch animation, you feel like you can be part of that story. You can always be those people, because animation in a beautiful way isn't real. And it's so unreal that it feels real. So when you're watching an animated movie or a short, you have this ability to sort of dive into it fully, because it's almost like watching a dream rather than when you're watching live action, you're seeing another human being. But animation, when you see somebody of color and you go into that world, you can suddenly sort of, I don't know, you can be closer in their shoes. You can empathize and sympathize and relate to them much more. And I feel like that's been so important to me, especially since after making these shorts, I've been looking around and I am one of the only young Black men doing what I'm doing in the animation community. And although I love live action very much, I do feel this need to continue what I'm doing so that I can open the door for other young Black people, you know, to do this as well. Because I feel like the more people that look like me and us behind the animation world, the more of these stories that we can tell and that we can see. So yeah.
Fantastic. And Carlos, for me, Home Is Somewhere Else was so resonant because of the way that it shows this cross-cultural experience and sort of especially children living on both sides of immigration, and also that it validates Spanglish as a language. So I think that there are really interesting layers to both choosing a different representational style to, again, getting back to what Cameron said about making the personal universal and allowing more people to both see kind of a quote unquote literal representation of the many cultures that make up our world, but also giving it more space and letting you sort of connect in different ways and not be bound by a photographic realism. So tell us about the thoughts that you and Jorge had in terms of representing the realities of your subjects in Home Is Somewhere Else.
Well, one of the things that Jorge and I have always talked when, I mean, we've been friends for over 30 years, but we have been working for over 25 years together. And we are always wondering, you know, especially like, how do you get the emotional aspect of these stories through? Because, for instance, most of the documentaries that I see that are, let's say, about migration, they focus on the system. And they focus on what the system is doing wrong. And it's very valuable to have this, you know, like this other kind of representation. It's very valuable to have all the data about what's happening. it's valuable to analyze and to rationalize what are these two countries now, being Mexico and the US, but any two countries, what's the relationship with migrant families? But we have always wondered, why don't we do it, you know, from the emotional point of view of the families? And I think that this is, we've been very surprised by, for instance, when we went to the San Diego Latino Film Festival and we had an incredible screening. It was packed, and you could see, you could feel everyone that was laughing out loud and then crying, and you could feel that they knew what everything that the film was talking about. Personally, they had experienced that. And most of the comments afterwards were, thank you for this representation. Thank you for this representation. Like representing families as a loving, you know, loving, warm relationship, even in, you know, in this context, I think it's very valuable because it humanizes and it creates a bond of, because we, I mean, being, if you have a family or you, we have all been part of a family, just the thought of being afraid every day of family separation is quite a nightmare. And if that is told just through the real, what people really feel about each other, then you don't have to talk about the system. It's already there, I think.
I just want to say real quick, by the way, I wanted to congratulate you on winning at San Diego Latin Film Festival, by the way. But also I wanted to say one thing I forgot earlier was to sort of echo some of the things that Carlos was just saying about representation. One thing that I was really happy about, grab my hand, that we didn't really have in context at first because it was from my dad and people sort of brought to our attention through the festival circuit, was showcasing the love between two Black men on screen. It was incredible to see people's reaction to that, because that's what sort of inspired the story to me. I didn't even know my dad and my uncle were saying gay check to each other every day until my uncle was in the hospital. And that, the beauty of that, is what brought me to Pedro to be like, yo, I need to do something with this. Like, there's a story here, and I think it would help my dad sort of have a never ending sort of eulogy or milestone or tombstone, whatever you want to call it, something that sort of keeps my uncle alive in his passing, to sort of show the love between these two men, but also specifically Black men, but specifically military Southern Black men, like the levels of the rarity that was. It was very nice that we got to put that on the big screen.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something really interesting that both of your films do, is that they upend the perception, hopefully the misperception, but sometimes it's on the nose, of documentary, you know, really sort of focusing on the challenging, the sometimes desperate stories of people, and them feeling like they're being told from the outside, right? So kudos to you all for really being thoughtful in terms of your representation of, you know, the beauty and the complexity and the multifacetedness of families of color. So thank you. The other thing I wanted to touch on that you both have expressed in different ways, but I really want to dig into it now, given that we're having this conversation around Doc Leipzig's festival, and also coming from a festival myself, is just what you think the impact of watching films communally, of actually gathering in a theater and having that viewing experience together, sharing reactions together, having interactions with the audience, what that impact has been for you. So, Camrys, do you want to start?
Sure. I think that going to the theater and watching a movie is one of my favorite pastimes, because there's something about it that's quite meditative. I love the idea and the concept of going somewhere to experience art, and my phone cannot be on. I like that I cannot contact other people and they cannot contact me for a few hours. And also, as we know, art reflects life, life reflects art. So in many ways, we are able to learn a bit about the world around us slash show an audience a little bit about the world around them. And we just have their attention for a bit, like for this small moment of time, the small part of your day and your week and your month and your year, you're allowing me to tell you something. And you're allowing yourself to not be distracted by anything or anyone in order to receive that info, that story, that message. So I think it's one thing that I don't believe will ever die, because it is something that we, I think we can all agree that there is a magic when watching a film in a theater.
Yeah, to me, I think there's something about sharing with people that are different from you. Stories like these, especially, you know, Homes from Our House and our film, I think it shows you the raw power of story. You know, like if you see all these people that maybe have nothing to do with you, they have all different backgrounds, but they all like gather in one place and they all were touched in some way by the same story, right? Like even if the characters don't look like you, if the characters don't represent what's going on with you right now, you get something out of it that will reach, right? And that's, you know, seeing that happening live, you can, you know, you can read on internet reviews and comments and everything of people, people's reaction of something, but being there and, you know, at the end of the movie, seeing the faces that are results of the same film that you just watched is just incredible too.
Yeah, for me, I mean, we have seen our film so many times that there's a point where you have already memorized it. And sometimes, you know, when you're in a theater, when someone is going to laugh, and then if they don't laugh, you say, oh my God, it didn't work. And sometimes, but I think that it's like the greatest gift when you're a filmmaker and you are, it's this opportunity to be surrounded by people that are feeling something through your movie. We always talk about San Diego, the one screening in San Diego, because you could feel the room breathe. I mean, it was like if it was alive, and everyone was like very in. You can hear the breathe when they are moved, and the laughs of some things that maybe for you are not so funny, but someone connects. So It has been really, really incredible to have the chance to be all these years since we first screened it, and to be in so many different places with so many different contexts. Sometimes you think that just people who have lived these kind of stories will connect, but then you learn that, and that's, I think that's the beauty of this, that you are making something that it's a very particular story you achieved to make it like universal. And when kids from all ages and all nationalities approach to you at the end and tell you, I feel the same because I also was born in the US and my father, and no. And so, yeah, I think that's beautiful. I think that's one of the greatest things that this movie has gave us back.
And also, you know, like, it's been funny because we are not the first pick from a documentary film festival, but we were at IDFA and we won the Best Documentary for Young Audiences Award. And we are not the first pick from animation festivals, but we had our world premiere in Annecy in a vision competition. And it was like, we are in Annecy. And then we were at the New York International Children Film Festival. And we have been now asked from other children film festivals to screen it there, and from Latino film festivals. And you know, this is something that is quite complex. And we like that because you're meeting very different audiences. Last weekend, we received a beautiful award from the Mexico City International Children Film Festival. And their jury were like 12 kids from 6 to 13 years old. And when they gave us the award, the kid that was, you know, that took the mic and started to tell why they were giving it, he was like 7 years old or 8 years old. And he was being like so incredibly professional reading the what the jury had written. And it was so direct, so honest, and so personal that I'm like, I mean, are we going to lose this? Are we going to lose going to the cinema, being as storytellers, just being there when audience is experiencing the film? I cannot imagine. For me, a movie theater is like a temple. And, you know, in Mexico, the Cinematheque, Jorge and I always go there and say, this is incredible place, you know, just people honoring this, just going to see film and honoring that as something important for their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've seen how well your films connect with audiences. And I think one of the takeaways that I want people to have is really grounded in like your suggestions for practice. You know, we love talking about theory, and that's important, but so often, you know, the excitement and the way the audiences are moved, in particular young audiences, and inspired, they're very curious to have more insights into your practice and sort of where they could go next. So I'd love just a little bit of takeaway. You both have been so eloquent about the way that you exchange ideas as teams, but if you want to maybe give a few suggestions to our listeners out there who are inspired by this conversation and want to deepen their own practice, whether they're coming from documentary animation or what have you, but what would you say to them?
So is the question kind of like, what do you say to like to find a co-director, like to find a collaborator, or?
Sorry, let me clarify. My question is really just a general one about generating ideas and how any kind of practical thoughts about your practice, sort of what has worked for you in terms of developing an idea and actually getting it to realization on screen. And a lot of what I'm hearing today really sounds like deep listening and collaboration and freedom in terms of exchanging ideas, whether that's visually, whether that's through concepts, but a sort of back and forth, it sounds like.
What I'll say is, as a director, I've only been directing now for 4 years, and I hope that I never lose this. I'm constantly feeling like I'm only as good as my team, I'm constantly feeling like I need to work with a team that is much better at what they do than I am at what I do. So whenever I'm working on a project, I love to have someone on my direct team that I think, you're so good at what you do, I can say anything to you and you will either get what I'm saying or you have a better solution. So working with people like Pedro, where I just like say, I have this crazy idea for this short film and it's, and you know, there's dialogue and there's scenes and there's this and there's that. And for him to go, yes, but, you know, yes, and we could do this version of it where the thing that you presented me works, but here's another idea. And then one of my best friends, Cosi Barnhart, did something similar for our comic book Tower, where I pitched them this concept. And the next day they sent me this email of like, you don't have to use this, but here's a bunch of ideas of what you could do for this comic book of yours, which made me then ask them to be my co-writer. Like finding people that not only inspire you, but you can also inspire. Like it feels like it's someone that you can build on top of. You can build the perfect version of the story that you're trying to tell. I think that's how I like to direct, is collaboratively. I like to make sure that I'm directing as a community, because if you're not listening to, you know, all the people around you, then there's no way that you can come up with the best version of what this film can be.
Yeah. One advice that I would give or a suggestion is for someone that wants to put their ideas out there is just let the medium inspire but not limit your output. You know, like from like several talking points that we had today, Jorge, for example, in the beginning when he was talking about like animation being a good entry point for a documentary, I think vice versa also works. You know, like animation, especially in the West, is always viewed as something for kids, right? So it's like at one point in your life, you just abandon that medium and then you try to focus on something else. But being, you know, an animated documentary, I think it brings back this attention to, oh, animation can tell real stories, right? So there's no limitation to the medium. This is the medium that we chose. We gave our reasons why, and that's how we found our voice. But it shouldn't, you know, if we had to tell the stories in some other way, I think it wouldn't have stopped us, you know, if we believed in what we were saying.
Yes, and for us, I think the most important and the best decision we took, and it was the reason why we could finish this film on time and with the limited budget we had, was to understand that this was a collaborative process, that it wasn't just us trying, like directors or producer, to make this with all the effort, but to ask for help for a lot of people, for friends, for different studios. We reached three independent studios that also, as us, are very little independent animation studios that are called, one is called Llamarada, the other one is Cassiopeia, and the other one is Virus Mecánico. None of these four studios, including us, had ever made a feature animated film. And I think that if we had tried to make it by ourselves, I don't know if we could have made it. I think that the reason why we could do it is because we said, let's join our forces and let's make the workflow like more horizontal, in the sense that it's not just the director saying to the animators, now you do this, and to the storyboard, but let's all sit in the same table and let's talk about this scene. What do you imagine? What's happening when Evelyn is telling her grandmother about her fear of not supporting her family, and suddenly the storyboard artist remembers something about his childhood and the feeling of her grandmother combing, no, the hair of her family. And then he came out with this idea that it's now one of the most beautiful scenes of the film, and that we like a lot. And like this example, there's a lot of scenes and sequences in the film that came from the ideas of a lot of more than 70 artists that we work with in the studios. And for us, I think that was like maybe one of the best parts, to be able to have this creative process that was always open. And I think that defined the spirit of the film. And I think that when you see this film and you see so much like layers and details, it's because it comes from so many peoples and so many energies and so many spirits. I think that's what made this film, that it has, a lot of people say it has a lot of heart. I think it has a lot of hearts, like hundreds of hearts. So I think that's what I most like about, and what I would advise, to ask for help always.
I love that, hundreds of hearts.
And I would say, you know, just do it. You know, just do it. Because like now that, you know, like a lot of the storytellers in our world come from going to school and studying something, and they tell you, you know, to do everything, you know, like to plan everything and to get your budget ready and to get the money and to get, you know, and then it's like, you know, if you're not going to do all that and you're not going to get all the money to do what it is that you want to do, you're not going to do it. And, you know, contrary to this, if you're just doing it, you know, then you discover that you can do it. And then, you know, that's like a start for a career attitude as well. And then you find friends that help you. And then these friends become, you know, the most valuable assets of your creative relationship. I think that this is what I would advise anyone. Just do it. You know, it's difficult, yeah, to do documentary and animation, put it all together. It's difficult. Yes, it is. But just do it. You know?
I love it. Well, I've got to thank the four of you for just doing it and doing it so beautifully in this amazing, inspired conversation. I encourage you all to check out these fantastic films and filmmakers. There'll be links associated with the podcast. Home is Somewhere Else is an incredibly meaningful film that has real impact behind it. And heartily encourage you to check that out. Grab My Hand, A Letter to My Dad, starting out as a personal story that is obviously so meaningful to so many and so inspiring. And I'm so grateful to the four of you for being here. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I also
thank you again.
So nice to meet you all.
Yeah. Right back at you.
Absolutely. And I'm excited for us to gather somewhere in person again, perhaps at Doc Leipzig, perhaps at the New York International Children's Film Festival, but definitely the importance of being in community and in dialogue, both virtually and in person, can't be overstated. So thank you. I also want to give a special shout out and thanks to Annalisa Reitfeldt and Lucy Mukherjee, who have helped to facilitate the Doc Leipzig podcast and have been really important thought leaders in this space as well. So very appreciative. And again, check out these beautiful films and filmmakers and be inspired and just do it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, MC.
Thank you.
Thank you all.